Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Effects. Welcome to this 256th day of the year. No, this is even further along. 263rd day of the year. We're just on the brink of the equinox, autumnal equinox coming in 3 days. Seasons are opposite on either side of the equator, so the equinox in September is also known as the autumnal equinox, where we are in the northern hemisphere, and the vernal, the spring equinox, if you happen to be south of the hemisphere. Then there, of course, are two every year, one in September and another coming in March. The sun's directly over the equator. The length of day and night is nearly equal. So we, of course, attach remarkable spiritual and metaphysical qualities to this type of event. Whether it's fun for you or preoccupation or gives you that sense of connection with our past, it's a peculiarity that allows us, it's a phenomena that allows us to anticipate the change of the seasons. So 3 days from now. Today we're going to be celebrating interesting music. I've selected ancient music from four of the major cultures in the world: ancient Egypt, Greece, Arabian culture, and China. Oh, and of course, because of me, Celtic. And many of the listeners, I suspect, have some Celtic genes coursing through their veins. Anyway, we'll just give you a little bit of sample before we tuck into, I think, a fairly interesting aspect of Freemasonry. And So stay with us for the next hour. It should be an interesting discussion today. This is Egypt. Music around the age of the pyramids. It's called the Dance of Ba. Thank you. the wealthy would have heard generations ago, yeah? A couple of thousand years ago. So just a sample, just a taste of the music that men would have heard that long ago. The program today is something that I've entitled Knocking on Heaven's Door. I know it's not the first time that that's been used, but I want to play something that motivated me. And this is by a writer called, that you'll know, Ralph Waldo Emerson. We played him, we've referenced his work on the program a couple of years ago, but tended to leave that alone for a while. He was what's called a metaphysical writer, had some really quite enriched poetry, really quite interesting poetry. He was happened to be an American, but for the grace of God, he was a lecturer. And he was he led the Transcendentalist movement in the 19th century, if you can imagine. He championed the idea of the individualism. He had no idea, like any of us, what would come out of that. Because he couldn't predict the future, but in the time, the checks and balances, it was enormously interesting for people to reconsider their state of being. Transcendentalism is a philosophical movement that was started around the 1820s and 30s in the eastern regions of the United States. And it was a protest against the general state of intellectualism and spirituality. The doctrine of the Unitarian Church that was taught in Harvard Divinity School was a particular concern. I won't get into that, but remember, this is the nation where you had you had Pilgrims and Quakers. This is a nation built on severe. The search to be allowed to practice. Now, just run that forward to today's setting. Again, these people had no idea the outcomes and what would be fostered. And take a look at and examine these cultures according to the way that people connect and show a reverence for the divine. And ask yourself if that's if severity is the necessary way in order for people to live a good life. Of course, I was reading this week that everywhere on the face of the earth where gin and tonic is served, the quality of life is higher. There is a greater social and political stability. An interesting correlation, not necessarily cause and effect. And if you put up bistros that sell gin and tonic, that you're going to have those kind of outcomes. But it's something that happens in those and around those environments, something to play with. This is a reading on self-reliance by Waldo Emerson. I want you to it's not very long. I'll cut it off because it goes on for quite some time. But just to give you an idea, okay?
Nay te quasi veris extra. Man is his own star, and the soul that can render an honest and a perfect man commands all light, all influence, all fate. Nothing to him falls early or too late. Our acts, our angels are, or good or ill, our fatal shadows that walk by us still. Epilogue to Beaumont and Fletcher's Honest Man's Fortune. Cast the bantling on the rocks. Suckle him with the she-wolf's teat, wintered with the hawk and fox, power and speed be hands and feet. I read the other day some verses written by an eminent painter which were original and not conventional. The soul always hears an admonition in such lines, let the subject be what it may. The sentiment they instill is of more value than any thought they may contain. To believe your own thought, to believe that what is true for you in your private heart is true for all men, that is genius. Speak your latent conviction, and it shall be the universal sense. For the inmost in due time becomes the outmost, and our first thought is rendered back to us by the trumpets of the last judgment. Familiar as the voice of the mind is to each, the highest merit we ascribe to Moses, Plato, and Milton is that they set at naught books and traditions, and spoke not what men, but what they thought. A man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across his mind from within more than the luster of the firmament of bards and sages. Yet he dismisses without notice his thought because it is his. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty. Great works of art have no more affecting lesson for us than this. They teach us to abide by our spontaneous impression with good-humored inflexibility the most when the whole cry of voices is on the other side. Else tomorrow, a stranger will say with masterly good sense, precisely what we have thought and felt all the time, and we shall be forced to take with shame our own opinion from another. There is a time in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself for better or worse as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his toil, bestowed on that plot of ground which is given to him to till. The power which resides in him is new in nature, and none but he knows what that is which he can do, nor does he know until he has tried.
Gives you just a taste. And from that, this. God only knows what I'd be without masonry. Masonry knocking on heaven's door. Does natural law alone teach us what we need to know to live with insight, to become insightful? Well, of course it does. But be cautious. Be cautious. When you become intellectually mature, you don't rely on a shepherd as the rest of the sheep. The contemporary Masonic environment is still, as it always has been, aspirational. Oaks in the forest, not deferring to power or politics. But though the man may be of objectionable fabric, a man succumbing to the nature of processes begun out of memory, you can see that masonry in many, many ways is an expression of natural law. Natural law, again, is a philosophy that certain rights or values are inherent by virtue of human nature. That which Emerson was writing about as inside us, to say what's deepest inside of us. And universally recognizable through human reason. Historically, natural law refers to the use of reason to analyze both social and personal human nature, to deduce binding rules of moral behavior, a touchstone for Freemason. The law of nature, being determined by nature, is universal. We hear this repeated, echoed in the lodges repeatedly. And not only there are other people outside of masonry. Although natural law is often conflated with common law, the two are very distinct. Common law is not based on inherent rights, but is the legal tradition whereby certain rights and values are legally recognized by virtue of already having judicial recognition or articulation. Back, that's the history that has been passed down to us, whether it was from the Agora in Greece or from the Druid. The ideas have been complementary and recognizable in different disguises. Natural law is often contrasted with human-made laws, or what's known as positive law, of a given political community or society or state. In legal theory, the interpretation of a human-made law requires some reference to natural law. Some jurists and scholars use natural law synonymously with natural justice or natural right. Comes from the Latin eius naturale, while others distinguish between natural law and natural light. These theories have exercised a profound influence in the development of English common law. I'll speak primarily to this because it's primary to the nature of my history and the common history of many millions of people in this area of the world. So declarationism argues that's a legal philosophy. It argues that the founding of the United States is based on natural law because of the intersection between natural law and natural rights. Within the American Declaration of Independence, building on natural law, philosophies such as consent of the governed replace the old world governance doctrine of the divine right of kings. These philosophies, like social contract theory, came of age during the Age of Enlightenment. Are you enlightenment? Are you enlightened? Let's hope. And somebody that gains a lot of respect for many Masons is that wrote about these ideas that can be found in Roman law and Greek philosophy and ancient Buddhist texts was the work of John Locke. Natural law theories are featured frequently in the work of Thomas Aquinas, so Berrico Gentili, Francesco Suarez, Richard Hooker, Thomas Hobbes, Hugo Grotius, Samuel von Pufendorf, Locke, and Francis Hutcheson, Jean-Jacques Boulamacque, and Francesco Mario Pagano. So just to give you a taste of what it is that we're talking about. Now, I'll give you reference here. When we come back, just listen to a little taste again. This one's of ancient Chinese. We're going to come back and I'm going to talk about the work of Jessica Harlan Jacobs. Some of you heard her speak at the Thank You Lectures series a few years ago, and we'll be referencing your work on Builders of the Empire. This is Chinese ancient music. Thank you. Pass. The bright moon lifts from the mountain of heaven in an infinite haze of cloud and sea. Remember, the Chinese cultivated a process of eidetic memory in the expression of the art. It didn't have the uniformity that the proportion that the Egyptians expected in the perfection of art. Even the perspective, as you can see when you look at our Egyptian art today, is quite uniform. What the Chinese artist did was he was expected to remember all of the detail from memory. And so when you had the memory fully in your mind, that you picked up a brush and pot of ink and you expressed that image in your mind at once, spontaneously. It was a very quick act. Now, it was unlike, you could see Michelangelo going back to the fresco in the Sistine Chapel, and he was known to go back after weeks or months and just to pick up a brush and add just a few strokes and then walk away again. Well, 4 years of work, a different approach. Now, while I've got this, while we're on this topic, this is the very oldest known melody. This is about 1400 BC. It's called a Hurrian hymn. Thank you. known melody. Now, that was discovered in the 50s in Ugarit, Syria, under tremendous cultural pressure right now. So if you were ever wondering what the first melody sounded like, that's the oldest that we've found so far, and so we'll call that the oldest, that there's the oldest known. There may be older. You can think so far, in listening to this music, we're hearing that it drew on thought, it drew on the imagination, it drew on the emotion of the time. But I want to ask you, of course, did Masonry, we're ascribing some great things to Freemasons, and I want to make the argument that it's valid to do that with a caveat, with an explanation, of course. Goes without saying. You remember, if you've slipped through Professor Harlan Jacobs' work, Builders of the Empire, her subtitle is Freemasonry and British Imperialism between 1717 and 1927. And she says to us that they built some of the first communal structures on the empire's frontiers. What she's the subtext of that is that it was enhanced by the fact that these men carried in common some principles and a philosophy known as Freemasonry. The empire's most powerful proconsuls sought entrance into their lodges. Their public rituals drew dense crowds from Montreal to Madras. The ancient, free, and accepted Masons were quintessential builders of empire, argues Jessica Harlan Jacobs. The Brotherhood attracted merchants, colonial administrators, soldiers, and ordinary colonists who were drawn to its rituals, conviviality, and fraternalism, and used its global network to facilitate their movements across the empire. It's a peer group of a sort. If this was the first study of the relationship between Freemasonry and British imperialism, and the book takes us on a journey across two centuries and five continents, and it demonstrates that the movement it left from the moment it left the British shores proved central to the building and cohesion of the British Empire. When you think about it, it begins to make sense that what that tells us is that there was and is a familiarity. We know it within Freemasonry because we can knock on the door of a lodge anywhere. And there is modes of recognition. But I would say none more so than the attitude a charlatan, somebody trying to buy an apron somewhere, acquire it somehow. An imposter coming to the door of a lodge would be evident because of the way they would act. There's I'm not talking about sheep and the shepherd now. I'm talking about the protocol, the manners of Freemasonry that we express everywhere. Now, I'm part of a branch of the order that likes to address well and to demonstrate through our presence the specialness of the event. Other places emphasize the comfort level, the casualness of the event. Now, we, tomato, tomato, I suppose, but I don't feel comfortable unless I'm perhaps in a tuxedo or a business suit or tails, whatever is appropriate to the setting. But around the globe, there are different manners and social norms and mores that we are to respect. We don't pretend, we're not superficial, that we're going to be a quasi version of East India when we're attending a lodge in Calcutta. We acknowledge that distinction. Maybe or if we're in Israel, or if we're in Moscow, or in Russia, or you know, if we're in Beijing, there are different cultural expectations that we get. So this isn't very, very good. Although the interesting part is, Harlan Jacobs is talking about imperialism, which is the curiosity, the thrust with the military might to make these things happen, not for the sake of making them happen, but to expand the trade, to expand a form of commerce and to organize it into something cohesive and recognizable that could allow trade with Europe and Britain. And bringing that around the world so you can see the clash of cultures and the need to have and the need in their minds to dominate the existing cultures. Now, has there been repercussions, ripples? Well, those tidal waves have reached our shores a long time ago. Imperialism did allow for commerce and common language to develop, defining common good as not you. The common good was what benefited the imperialist view, not the wreckage that it left behind for the local populations and culture. The local culture was suppressed. Today it wouldn't happen. The Boxer Revolution would not happen. Perhaps we would say that the reasons, you know, the trade in opium that was forced into China by this process would not happen, but that would be naive. As Edward Snowden has revealed, there are things about powerful nations that reflect the appetite and fear of what happens if you lose status. In the general thinking, the loss of power means a domination by another imperialist power. Along with inside that envelope, inside that whole journey process here, we learned that that Freemasonry left an indelible stamp that was outside of the military and judicial processes. It was the organization that emerged in 1770 as a fraternity, identified with the ideals of Enlightenment cosmopolitanism. We live, we acquire, we trade, we share. And universal brotherhood and sociability and benevolence are aspects of this fraternity. So these are things that went with the people that were part of the imperial armies. This spread, interesting thing, it was able to spread. Now, we can say, well, this was just terrible, and what it did was terrible, in hindsight. But we can also say, who else was attempting this? Well, in one period of time, we know that Portugal and Holland and Spain and France was also attempting these feats of domination. But one was able to actually commit the necessary resources. Remember, this was not friendly times. If you were enticed into a pub, you and I were enticed into a pub in the day, and would sit there drinking our rum, or if we didn't have a lot of money, we'd be sipping our gin and an ale, and get into well into our cups, the press gangs would grab us up, and a great many of the soldiers and sailors that fought in these battles that were the results that we're talking about were men that were not there willingly. These were men that were beaten into submission. Often died from disease. They were an unhappy bunch and looked it. These weren't, they were fighting because they were compelled to fight by the military structure. So this wasn't a gleeful domination of culture. This isn't Scotland gaining, this isn't the Robert the Bruce gaining freedoms for his people. This is a political military machine bringing about trade by military might. Now, we've seen vestiges of that in the 80s in the Middle East, so we know that that hasn't changed. Not that the power was the Middle East. The power was probably the last gasp of a dying Western military force that now has to share both the economic and military political influence with other players. Time has evolved. Time has moved on, and it's brought change. By the 19th century, Masons continued to champion an ideology of openness, but in practice, the Brotherhood shied away from its cosmopolitan and radical pasts. Buffeted by the strengthening currents of nationalism, capitalism, and imperialism, the Masonic Brotherhood emerged as a loyal Protestant and well-respected brotherhood that identified itself as an unquestioning ally of the imperial state. When British Freemasons began admitting the indigenous elites toward the end of the century, they did so primarily on the grounds that native participation in Masonry would strengthen the empire. Meanwhile, Masonic ideology remained susceptible to revolutionary interpretations. Examining how the Brotherhood and the Empire transformed each other involved issues of globalization, supranatural, not super, supra, large national identities, imperial power, fraternalism, and masculinity. This is a very, it still is a very muscular group. You see that reaction. It could talk about change, but be very cautious about how change is brought about. Even with the development from the 20s of public relations and propaganda and manipulation of large numbers of people, it's still prone to those. But the struggle, as we know, has been to express the enlightenment that it talks about. Does it have a platform to encourage innovation, innovative analysis of the philosophy? Well, really, here in this part of the world, there's no barriers whatsoever to doing that. None whatsoever. You're free to do it. Where we stumble off the edge of the cliff is when it becomes insensitive to certain familiar parts of our practice of Freemasonry. And that insensitivity is simply bad manners. It's not anything. But boys being boys, it will trigger temper tantrums for some that are unable to articulate that irritation and that insensitivity any other way. Temper tantrums are never very flattering, particularly of men of our age. Neither is being overboard about our criticism of other people or acting as if our egos are the predominant imperial force in the room. Builders of Empire makes a significant contribution to the history of Masons and Imperial Britain and transnational history. But I want to ask you, when you think you consider that idea, does it have merit for you that when we talk about the influence of Masonry and how imperialism has influenced Masonry and how Freemasonry has influenced imperialism. What we're hearing is that out of our sense of enlightenment, our sense of our quest for knowledge, our curiosity, outcomes, different outcomes, our involvement in different outcomes can be put at our feet as a result of us, and I would add an unintended result or an unexpected result, because never are we able to predict. We can the future, we can lay claim to it that in 1,000 years, you know, we've heard those demagogues, in 1,000 years, everybody will still be speaking my name, blah, 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 blah. Today, we're a product of the study of all of those different influences, from the despots that are still running around the African continent. That's where the world is shining its light right now. Where the interruption of slavery and the suppression of very old cultures and political structures interrupted the natural evolution of great nations, and they're left to struggle to clean up the disorder left when the imperialists moved away. There was no book of rules to follow when the imperial power left. So just as we're seeing in the Middle East, where, you know, a despot has been killed, there is behind that the risk of chaos. Not at all very pleasant. So you've heard the music we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back here. We're going to listen to a bit of the music of ancient Greece. This is really quite interesting. Remember, by the way, there's no connection between the ancient Macedonians of Alexander the Great, who are related to this other Hellenic tribes, and the so-called modern Macedonians, if that's important to you. Macedonia is a great nation. Ancient Greek music. So you're sitting back, you're part of the privileged, and here's what you listen to. What image does it conjure up in your mind? Production, wouldn't you say? It doesn't really do justice to the ancient music, but it's It's there. You can hear that the blend of voice and instrument. On the theme of the building, Emerson says, he builded better than he knew. The conscious stone to beauty grew. That's from his poem, The Problem, written in 1847. He builded better than he knew. In other words, we're doing things without having a fully deterministic sense of what's going to happen. We're not mathematics. We don't have that Euclidean fractal geometry to determine the functions of our and outcomes of the formulations that we pull together as we make decisions and go through our lives. It's approximations. We aim for something in general terms, and generally we translate our outcomes to meet our expectations. We did something intending that it would be better and an advantage, and it was. Very rarely, it only takes some of those stray gene pools to think that we're going to do something that's very destructive. Remember, it's human nature. We don't like negative discovery. Even when our scientists have made great gains, if it's a positive, we've learned something, we can celebrate it. We can have a party. We can have awards. But when we're finding that something, an assumption, isn't true, then we don't necessarily like that. That's considered negative discovery. We're unhappy as people. We don't celebrate it because we don't really know intellectually what to do with that. So even in Freemasonry, if we've discovered anything, we look at things truthfully and realistically. We want to be able to have, at the end of the day, have a better understanding of what was going on around us. That means, as we examine history, we do it in an unvarnished way, the raw history. What really happened? So that entails some very difficult tasks, very much in line with the goal of eidetic memory that the Chinese set for as an expectation for their painters. It's a daunting task. But once we put our minds to it, we realize that we can train ourselves to understand the world around us through the eyes of other people. The genius is to be able to hold competing worldviews or competing views of reality in the mind at the same time. And then we can examine that sense of right and wrong, perhaps to arrive at that point of natural law, of what is inherent to human nature. So those questions are still as daunting for a man today as they were 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. We're coming to an end of the show really quite quickly. I have some more references by Manly P. Hall, which I think are just really quite enlightening. The work of Manly P. Hall has really presented us with a gold mine of thinking and ideas. Some of us think that we need to understand what this sense of spiritualism is about Freemasonry. And within Freemasonry, what is the esoteric nature of our order? Well, this is where the study usually branches off into discussions of considerable contemplation. Not necessarily something that enlivens a room of 100 men. This is more the conversation between two good friends over a glass of scotch or a cup of tea, if you're thinking in the beverage of the period, where we go to our version of the coffee house to listen, to be influenced, and to debate. We shy away from that largely, and I think it might be that we're uncomfortable thinking that all debate, all dissension is somehow wrong. Well, you can live that way for a quite long time, but you know, it's not quite accurate to say that. In fact, it limits our sense of understanding. Here's a little bit of work from something that I picked up, who knows how. This is written by J.D. Buck. He was an M.D. This is called The Mystic Masonry, or The Symbols of Freemasonry and the Greater Mysteries of Antiquity. And this comes to us from Cincinnati, the Robert Clark Company, in 1897. So a nice little quote on the frontispiece. A few rudimentary lessons in architecture, a few universally admitted maxims of morality, a few unimportant traditions whose real meaning is unknown or misunderstood, will no longer satisfy the earnest inquiry after Masonic truth. Those are the words ascribed to Albert Pike in Morals and Dogma. Is there something to it? Of course. Of course. So here, Buck writes, in the great majority of cases with the agent, death is looked upon with uncertainty or fear as a blessed release from suffering and sorrow. Life is thus endured as a necessary evil and is more often voted by the individual to be a failure than a success. What life ought to be is often conceived from our many failures. In other words, it's not whether failure shapes our life, it's our reaction to failures that determines our character. What life ought to be is often conceived from our many failures, he says. And then goes on, what it might be is dimly perceived from the intuitions of the soul, which the struggles and selfishness of existence have failed to entirely obliterate. The intuitions of the soul. This is what Emerson was talking about. These things ought not to be so, nor need they be longer, if earnest men and women would seek diligently, first for the cause of all our ills, and secondly, for a sufficient remedy. This remedy is to be found first in knowledge. Nobody ever says that you can find all these answers if you just get into, if you just live in a state of intoxication. They never say that. It's knowledge. What you do to find it, well. Second, in service of the truth. So on one hand, one pillar is knowledge. Other is truth. So we're going to now come back and we're going to talk more about this. Let us now examine a little more in detail some of the conditions under which we suffer. The human condition. To help us understand why, will give us answers so that we don't have to go through our life and feel that this sense of failure, because we can examine from a point of truth, from a point of knowledge, we can examine and determine truth, the natural law. This is clearly designated in the age of science. The art of printing, the power of steam and electricity and applied science, the conservation and correlation of energy, and the theory of evolution and speculative science, with the resulting details, constitute the greater part of our real discoveries. One machine is made to do the work of a score or more of men, while the laborers who have been thus displaced have no adequate share in the profits of mechanical invention. Those who work with their hands are no longer artisans, but generally machines. a necessity as to different details for which no machine has yet been invented. The work of the laboring classes is thus reduced to the routine of drudgery without the hope of advancement, and therefore with no other incentive than to keep the wolf from the door. A manufactured article which, when completed, serves more often to foster extravagance and luxury than to supply a necessity, passes through many hands before it is completed. The laborer is glad even thus to serve, because idleness means starvation. And still, the army of the unemployed is an ever-increasing host. The occupation of the common laborer is even more precarious than that of the mechanic or the artisan. Is it any wonder, then, that in times of financial uncertainty, when thousands of laborers are out of employment and threatened with starvation, unable to apprehend the real causes of their suffering, naturally envious of those who are supplied with all the luxuries of life, and knowing that something is radically wrong somewhere to produce all of this inequality and injustice, band together to secure what they conceive to be their rights by force. We really need to talk. Come back and join me on Masonic Effects, where we examine the what's been happening as this ship travels, continues on its journey, and we take a look at what's been going on behind. We're going to close off the program with some of the music, ancient Arabian music, and we'll conclude with ancient Celtic music. Thank you very much for your support. Thank you for listening in today. We'll be in touch with you real soon.